Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So we're in the shed again. We're walking into the shed, and Collie, it's nice to be back. It's very nice to be back. Everyone's looking good.
Everybody is looking great.
How are my former flatmates, Terry and Fred?
Oh, Terry's asleep under here.
Yeah.
Our toad is, our tree frog is in there. It was calling last night.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, it was very unusual little.
Yeah, I used to hear him at home as well. Yeah. It was lovely.
So, yeah, they're all doing good.
Fantastic.
The place is a bit mucky because I was cleaning out some containers last night.
Welcome to the Critter Shed. This is episode number 50 and also the first episode in our fifth season, and we're delighted to be back. This episode was recorded last spring. It was one of those rare occasions that Collie and I actually managed to get together in the shed and share some terrific stories about wonderful animals. And of course, I got to say hello to a frog and a toad who used to live with me and have since moved to live with Uncle Collie. So, enjoy the show.
So today I was going to have a chat with you about one of my favourite little creatures, and I suppose it was a gateway drug for me, one of the many gateway drugs into nature and wildlife. And I cannot recommend, if anyone's out there who has an interest in native wildlife and wants to keep them as pets, It's a fantastic little creature. It's called the stickleback.
Stickleback. Now, I remember them as kids. I remember talking about them as kids. I don't really remember what they look like. All I remember is that they're small. And they're fish.
Yes, they're fish. They're small fish. So the first fish you'd probably catch in the UK and Ireland as a kid with a net in a pond.
Yeah, that was probably it.
Yeah, so we would call them minnows or pinkeens.
Yeah. Pinkeens, that was it.
Minnows also include the actual minnows, but people will mix them up with sticklebacks. And pinkeens is definitely a name in Ireland for them because the males have a very colourful belly, which we'll get into in a bit. In the UK, I believe their common name is a tiddler.
A tiddler, all right.
Yeah, which I think is where that expression comes from. So,
what expression?
The tiddler, like as in it being small.
Oh, right, yeah. Right, yeah.
Not that I know anything about that. But
ka-choo!
Boom, we're back!
And why do you want to talk about sticklebacks? Why are they amazing?
Well, it's this time of year. I was looking in a pond a while ago up in a place we visited in Terenure where we saw the newts.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to see a very cool behaviour that, as I said, if you collect a couple of sticklebacks and put them in a nice tank in your garden, a decent sized tank, they're not a jar, and we want to give them a good life. But they live quite happily in something like that. Not great to have in a wildlife pond if you have a small wildlife pond because they will eat tadpoles. Mm. So that's one to be watched. But if you want to observe some really cool behaviour, especially if you have younger kids or family members that you'd like to get them interested in nature, there's a great thing that sticklebacks are doing at this time of year, and that's something that's very unusual for fish, well, very unusual for our fish, and that's nest building.
Ah!
So I have a picture here.
Yeah.
So there you go. I love these old-fashioned...
So you've just pulled up this gorgeous sort of illustration of sticklebacks from a German book. It says, Großer Stichling.
Oh, very good.
That's the old fashioned. It's probably an old book. It's got the old font.
Oh, it is. It's definitely. I love these old. You'll see them up in kind of in old fashioned bars and stuff like that. And if you go to like really old encyclopedias, you'll see the very old kind of painted natural history paintings.
So this is a scene with three fish, and there's something in the middle that looks odd. Well, for a fish.
Yes. Yeah, so this pile here is created. First of all, we'll start off at the start of the year, so that's when the males come into breeding colours. The fish themselves, they're very small, slender fish, slender as in their body isn't wide. Their bodies can be quite deep.
And how long are they?
Maximum length would be about 10 centimetres.
Right.
But they vary between that and about 6.
Yeah.
Depending on their food that they have, depending on what kind of conditions they're living in. You can get them in everything. They're very unusual in this way. You can get them everywhere from salt water to brackish water to fresh water and ponds. Yeah. This is specifically the tree spined stickleback we're talking about. There's numerous species of sticklebacks, but the tree spined is the one I'm focusing on today.
Yeah.
In Ireland, we actually have another species called the 10-spined or the 9-spined stickleback, depending on who you ask. And in the UK, they have the 15-spined stickleback.
Oh, they would, wouldn't they?
And just to make it even more, and just to make it even more awkward, all of those stickleback, all those specific numbers on their spines, may have more or less than their name denotes. If that makes
just any to make
sense,
it really clear.
So you can have 3-spined stickleback with 4 spines or 2.
Right.
You can have 10-spined stickleback with 8 spines. It depends, because they're a very unusual creature, as in once they get into an area, they adapt very quickly, and it's almost like they speciate really fast. So if they were to move into a lake where there was mainly mosquito larvae that was feeding on the top level, their mouths will naturally, over generations, will quickly turn upward. Whereas if they're feeding in a muddy pond where all the food's on the bottom, their mouths can start to go downwards really quickly in a couple of generations.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and they're studied by science a lot because of that, because you can really see adaptation happening fast, especially in their armour plating. And that's where they get their name, stickleback, because they have 3 spines on their back, or 2 or 1 or whatever, whatever mood they're in. But they'll actually shoot up like almost like little spikes. It's like the spikes the police would roll out on the road to stop a car.
Yeah.
And they come out from the top of the fish and come out from the side. So if Mr. Pike or Mr. Perch is coming along, sees Mr. Stickleback or Mrs. Stickleback and wants to gobble them up, the spikes will lock out and they're really, really hard. Like they'll, if you were to grab the fish, it would pierce your skin. This is a real good deterrent. Now, it doesn't always work, but most of the time it will stop the predatory fish from swallowing the stickleback down.
Right.
You can eat. Actually, sometimes you can catch fish. If you're a fisherman, you might catch fish and you'll see a stickleback lodged in the throat of a larger predator. So it's a really useful way of defending themselves.
Wow.
Anyway, so the males in spring start to develop this beautiful red belly. It goes from the bottom of their...
See it there on the picture?
Yeah, it goes from the bottom of their mouth right down up to the dorsal fin. And that is to display to the females how vigorous and healthy he is. If he's got parasites, or if he hasn't fed very well, or if he's generally just malaise and not a healthy fish, that colour won't be as vigorous.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see also on the back there, he gets this kind of a bluey-green tint. Some isolated populations, the males will actually turn white on top.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very varied, and it's female selection driven. Mm-hmm. So the girls are kind of deciding who they're going to mate with, because they'll have the brighter colours and so forth. So then the males do a really weird thing. They'll dig out a small shallow pan in the bottom of the pond. They gather up a lot of sphagnum moss, algae, bits of plants, twigs, everything, and make them into a ball. And then they'll produce a secretion from their kidneys. And I think it's called spigot. And I think that's a Scandinavian word for stickleback, as far as I remember. But it's a secretion that they produce from their kidneys. And they basically charge headfirst into the ball that they just made on the ground and kind of carve out, for want of a better word, a hole in the middle, producing a little nest.
And sort of fortify it with this.
Fortify it with that spigot stuff that they stick it with.
Yeah.
And then wait for the females to arrive. Now, the females arrive to inspect the nest and also to inspect the male. And he'll do a kind of a zigzag dance in front of her, showing off his spikes, his belly. He'll be kind of really giving it socks to make sure that she's impressed. The funny thing about sticklebacks is, though, that it's not just the males that are, or the females that are selecting the males. The males will actually select the bigger and more rotund females.
Oh,
they like shapely, curvy women. They really do. And that's because the bigger females are of course, healthier.
Mm.
And they have more eggs. So a smaller female might only have 30 eggs, but she could have up to 200.
Yeah. So it's a mutual thing. They both have to swipe right.
It's very, very, yeah, it's they're very, very fussy. And it really does stand to this kind of quick evolution or quick adaptations, because instead of just one partner looking for a healthier mate, both are. So it's doubling the quality selection control.
That's amazing. Yeah. The picture of that nest that we're looking at, and also the behaviour, reminds me of what the bowerbirds do when the males build a nest.
Yeah, yeah.
That is for display purposes and to attract a female, and they do the dance. It's amazing to see
it's
that.
It's not that dissimilar. All they're short of doing is putting a bit of shiny stuff around the front. But once she goes in there, she'll lay the eggs. And again, like, this is stuff I used to watch. And I have vivid memories of watching it in my mum and dad's greenhouse in a fish tank. And you could, I was like, oh my God. Because I'd read about it, but you didn't think you'd see it. And then you see it happening. She lays the eggs. He'll follow in directly afterwards, fertilise them. And immediately he'll drive her off.
Like,
get the hell away. Yeah. They become super aggressive. Now, he can mate with a couple more females.
Yeah.
And basically fill the nest up.
Right.
And again, he'll become super aggressive. He'll even risk his own life to chase away predators and everything. They just turn into these lunatics, the males do.
Very defensive.
Very defensive. Then if it's in a low kind of oxygen content underwater in the pond, he'll actually fan them. So he'll sit over with his dorsal fins and his tail and kind of fan the water around to create this flow of oxygen over the eggs to make sure they're all healthy and happy. As soon as the babies hatch out, he'll protect them for another couple of days by actually swallowing them in his mouth and bringing them back to the nest. Yeah.
Wow.
It's incredibly.
So a big commitment there.
It's a big commitment for the males. And a lot of them actually kind of get really hungry because they go after food for this point, and they're kind of very, very protective.
Wow.
And then once it gets to a certain point, he'll break that connection and the young fish are off on their own. But they've got a great head start in life compared to a lot of other species. And that's why sticklebacks are so successful. So if you look at the nest, and we're talking about the nest, how he forms out with that that sticky chemical from his kidneys. This is another reason they're so successful, because you can imagine if you're a moorhen or a duck or a heron, those evil birds that I love so much.
Love herons, they're not herons. Evil.
I still have PTSD from the heron destroying my pond last year. But yeah, if one of them is wading through one of the shallower areas of the pond or anywhere where these eggs are, those eggs easily become stuck to the bird's feet and can be transferred from one pond to another. And that's why sometimes you see sticklebacks. I've seen sticklebacks in the craziest location I've seen them in that I know no one would have put them in was if you go down to the top of the Liffey near Houston Station.
Yeah.
Across it, there's a small little park where the Floozy in the Jacuzzi, a famous Dublin statue is. It's in a small pond. And beside the small pond, there's a fountain, a tiny fountain. And there were sticklebacks breeding in that.
That's insane.
And there's no other way they would have gotten there only for a bird landed with some stickleback flag on. Because nobody's, like, it's the city centre. Nobody's going to pop in a load of sticklebacks. So they either got transferred from the bigger pond beside it or from somewhere else. It was just one of those things I was looking at. I was like, that's really good evidence for that.
That is brilliant. That theory. So come here, they can live in freshwater, brackish water, or salt water. So are they subspecies then that live in these places? Or can an egg go from a stream into salt water?
They're incredibly adaptive. They're incredibly tolerant of changing from one to another. They're actually closely related. And if you look at her face when I tell you this, you'll go, oh, that makes sense. And the male's behaviour. They're closely related to seahorses and pipefish. Pipefish are the fish with the big long nose that look like they got a hook stuck in it and somebody pulled their face out. But you can see, you can imagine that. And as well with the male behaviour protecting the eggs, it's quite similar to what the male seahorses do by taking the babies on board.
But can they go from freshwater to saltwater, or do they have to change their biology, their physiology?
They just are very highly tolerant, so they can run from one to the other. What happens is, and what they reckon happens is with the species that are in ponds and lakes around here, what they would have been the saltwater that ran to freshwater species, but they just got trapped during the ice age and just stayed there.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So I would say if you pop the a stickleback from a pond in Wicklow into the Irish Sea, it mightn't do too well.
Right, yeah.
But it's just the adaptability of the species as a whole. Yep. That's that, gotcha. That if that makes sense. Gotcha. Like if we were doing survey work down in Bull Island at the golf links down there, and there's brackish streams that run through the links, which we were like, and it was a mistake I made. I assumed they were fresh. It was fresh water because I saw sticklebacks in there. And at the time, I wasn't aware of the fact that the tree-spine stickleback was quite tolerant to salt water.
Wow.
As well. So, yeah, it was because when I grew up with them, I just considered them a freshwater species.
That's an incredible adaptation because, I mean, to go from salt water to fresh water, like, you need to change practically the whole mechanism of your body.
Yeah. The seafaring, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
Sticklebacks.
Yeah.
They do travel into the fresh water to breed.
Oh, wow. Like salmon.
It's like salmon. So that, and it makes sense when you think about it, or into brackish pools to breed, because if you're that small a fish out in the big ocean, it would make sense to protect your young to go in a little bit more.
Yeah.
But yeah, what a fascinating little bunch of creatures.
Incredible.
I think they're amazing. Yeah. I absolutely love them. They're a magic thing. You'll know they're not minnow or small trout or small perch because they'll tend to, they hover in the water, if that makes sense. They have a wavy fin action. They can curl their back tail and almost swim backwards as well. So they have a very unusual pattern for a fish to swim in. Whereas a normal fish, you'll just, as you would imagine a fish to swim, it has that darty kind of action. Sticklebacks tend to hover around the water like miniature helicopters underwater. It's incredible. And yeah, really interesting fish to observe. Again, if you catch one or two, you'll know the difference between a male and a female in spring because you'll see that beautiful coloration on the male. And if you have a small tank in it and some kids around, it's a great thing to see and to observe yourself. There's nothing, I'll never forget seeing my first time the male constructing the nest and the display and everything.
Yeah.
And then once you're done, you can pop them back to where you found them. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, it really is a cool little thing. And they're awesome animals, underappreciated. And
yeah.
I think they're fantastic.
Showing the love for sticklebacks. I remember my brothers and myself catching them in ponds and just, you'd look at them in a jam jar and then you'd put them back.
That's it, yeah. Oh, I used to bring them home. God, I probably butchered about half the sticklebacks in Dublin at one stage. But like, I never much more conscious of it. They're doing well though. They're one of those, again, they're so adaptable. Mm. Like there's some streams we've been sampling that have been like piss poor for like biodiversity. Sticklebacks, not a bother. They're the great survivors. They're going to be around for a long time. They really do well. Oh yeah, and here's another thing, and it's a throwback to one of our other episodes that we did with Maureen, my pal Maureen Williams from Trinity. Remember we had her on to talk about parasites?
Yeah, amazing.
And she was telling us about how animals can be intermediary hosts. Mm. Did I say that word right?
You did.
Very good. So yeah, the sticklebacks are just that. They are a host, an in-between host from the stage of the of a type of liver fluke that affects birds and fish.
Oh.
So they are a host for this parasite.
Mm.
And the parasite changes the behaviour of the stickleback.
Oh, how?
It makes it less fearful and want to go up into the top of the water for Mr. Heron or Mr. Egret to eat.
Wow.
Isn't that fantastic?
It changes, like this tiny parasite changes the behaviour of the host animal that it's in and makes it do stuff so that the parasite can get onto its next stage.
Yeah.
That is wild.
Yeah.
By the way, if you haven't listened to the earlier episode about parasites, it's fascinating.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Fascinating.
Maureen's a fantastic science communicator and yeah, it's well worth a listen, and we're probably butchering the science of that, but that's it. And like, so there you go. So sticklebacks, unsung heroes of the pond, brilliant to observe and to look around. If you have some in your own wildlife pond, they are quite interesting. Not great to have too many of them if you want to have a lot of frogs and newts, because they tend to munch a lot of stuff that are smaller than them. But yeah, really, really interesting little critters. And get out and catch some and have a look at them.
Nice one. So would they chow down on the tadpoles that you have now?
Not now, not at the size they are now.
They're big, aren't they?
But when the tadpoles first hatch out, sticklebacks would have a go at them. Now, I've kept sticklebacks beside frogs for years, but you never have the numbers of frogs that you would have without the sticklebacks, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Fish and amphibians never mix very well in ponds,
yeah,
especially in garden ponds.
Yeah.
That's the rule. But yeah,
a lot of aiding going on.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Well, a big shout out to the Sticklebacks. I absolutely love them. Great memories growing up with them, and yeah, happy days.
Just goes to show the stuff that is around that you don't notice is, if you stop and look at them, absolutely wonderful.
That's what
amazing.
We're all about here, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Making the unsung heroes.
Yeah, exactly.
So now we're going to walk over into your house, Collie, because there's something else we would love to talk about. Something adorable and amazing, but also slightly uncomfortable and problematic at the same time. So we're opening the door into your house. We're walking into your living room, where there's
Hello,
a run.
Ah,
there's a big crate, and Ivy. Ivy has popped out, and she's the most adorable.
Pug.
Yeah. Lovely. So, she's 12 weeks old.
12 weeks old, yeah. Weeing on the carpet all the time.
Can't love her with excitement.
And yeah, and you can hear her snorting away there.
Yeah.
As pugs tend to do. And the reason why we're talking about pugs is because it is something that needs to be talked about.
Yeah. She's just running around the place. So much energy.
They're a flat-faced breed of dog. And a lot of flat-faced breeds of dogs and cats as well have these issues, these health issues. Now, I suppose when you get... I love animals and I want to make sure that they have the best quality of life.
Yeah.
So it might seem odd that I have a dog that's, you know, clearly not a great breed health-wise.
But like all your animals here, she was a rescue.
Yes, she was. We took her in. She was a friend of mine bred them and she had nowhere else to go. So we went and took her. Yeah. We're not going to breed her. She's going to be... living her life here. She might even have to get a little bit of work done on her nose.
Yeah.
As happens with dogs.
So as I'm looking at her now, she's very cute. She has a lovely colouring. She's light coloured on her ears and her
She's happy and healthy and running around like a mad thing.
But she's flat faced.
Yes.
And you can see that her nose is deeply recessed. So that must be hard for her.
It's hard. And, you know, according to my friends who are vets, it's like breathing through, you know, one of those high altitude masks that you have on.
Oh.
Or sometimes as bad as breathing through a straw.
And really?
Yeah, so it's really, really difficult for them to breathe. Now, she's not too bad. She hasn't got that. But some pugs can't, like, physically can't run around much at all. And, like...
Because they run out of oxygen and can't get enough back into their bodies.
My friend, who I know from Trinity, who's a nurse, a veterinary nurse at the moment, was telling me that she's heard people who come to the veterinary place looking for... rescue dogs or to and they want to get a pug because it won't need much walking because they can't breathe. And I mean, that's not a great attitude to have, obviously.
Yeah.
It's been addressed now by the British Medical Association or Veterinary Medical Association,
the reason
I believe.
That you're sort of breathing hard as she is running around like a wild thing and you try to control her. She's just full of energy.
So the vets in England basically have gotten together and come out and said, look, you can't look at them as a proper dog anymore. Now, this is a thing called breeding for show as opposed to breeding for health. The people who are doing the big dog shows, I won't mention any names, we know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
They have aesthetics that you want. And you can look at a picture of a pug from 100 years ago. 100 years ago,
wow.
1902.
Yeah.
And it looks like a different dog. It has a nose.
Really?
It has an actual nose like a dog. Actually, I have a photograph here. If you want to be.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. She's gone for my shoes now. Oh, there she is again. Who's the best girl?
There you go.
Oh my God, it looks like a totally different dog. Well, it looks like a pug with a nose, with a snout.
Yeah.
An actual proper snout.
So you can see what's happened over the years of selective breeding, looking for those, for the wrinkles and things.
Yeah.
And the wrinkles are another issue that they have with their health. So, I mean...
What do the wrinkles do?
They get infections and
folds of skin, I suppose. It'll be warm inside. And
exactly.
Yeah.
So look, the good thing about the kind of, I suppose, the vets taking a stand against it and stuff is that it's going to make people breed out the breed, I think, a little bit more and get it back to kind of a health based breed rather than appearance. Shows.
The thing that you were talking about is called the breed standard, where you have certain aesthetics that you want to reach for whoever's judging to say, yes, this is the best in show.
And it's
or
not only pugs. Pugs are the extreme end of it. But if you look at German Shepherds, they've got this slope back thing going on, which causes hip problems and all this. And look, I'm only hearing and talking secondhand from friends I know who have dogs who are experts in their field in dogs, which I'd eventually we're going to get someone on. I've got some good dog training friends and a couple of people who run kennels, so it'd be nice to have their point of view. But yeah, I think it was important just to mention, like, if you are getting a dog, to try and, you know,
first adopt, don't shop would be the main thing. Shop,
yeah. Try and rescue something if you can, and stay away from the big factory breeders.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and let's also hear some love for mixed breed dogs, what we used to call mongrels. Fabulous, fabulous animals.
See, I wanted a pair of jugs.
You what now?
You could breed a Jack Russell with a pug, and it's called a jug. So I wasn't asking for any favours there, auntie. I want a pair of jugs. But but like the likes of that now will be coming out, and you know, and just you could just get this breed into a much healthier state if it just kind of revert back to what they were originally. Yeah. You know.
She has so much energy. I've forgotten how young animals have so much energy.
It's like having a kid. But she is gorgeous and I love her, and she'd be well looked after and loved. But it's important to acknowledge the fact that it's difficult because I'd love to put a lot of pictures of her up because she is as cute as a button. She's been bred that way to look like a little kid.
Yeah, we're attracted by the big eyes. The big they remind eyes us of not, babies all and all that. Paid, yeah.
But it's not a healthy way for an animal to be. Despite her going absolutely nuts all the time.
I also heard about some of those dogs that have lots of foals where they slobber a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And that slobber just causes their skin to go red and they get infections and stuff. Course, so there's many issues.
Exactly. But look.
Basically, humans are shit.
Yeah, it's not her fault.
With their ornamental dogs.
Yeah, well, I mean, she won't be bred. Definitely not bred into pugs and probably not bred at all because there's less stress on her. And she's well loved in this family. But. Yeah, read up in it and look into yourselves and try not to encourage this kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Basically, I can have a pug, but no one else can have one. I don't mean to sound like that, though, but you know, I hope people understand where I'm coming from.
Absolutely, yeah.
There you go.
Very well, I think we should go off and play with the pug.
Yeah,
now.
Let's go.
Let's go and play with the pug. Ah! A lot of energy, come on.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.